The last category, or last aspect of the French crown's machinery I want to look at, was taxation. It's a topic we've discussed many times in earlier lectures, and we've seen how France's rise to great power status clearly depended upon the ability to wage war on an ever greater scale. But nevertheless, as has also been commented on extensively in earlier lectures, warfare in early modern Europe was not only extremely expensive, but it was becoming ever more so over the course of the 16th and the 17th centuries as a result of a number of trends. The feudal host, semi-private armies raised through the cliented networks of the great aristocrats, was gradually giving way to standing armies of mercenaries who had to be paid directly in cash. Moreover, the technology of war, new artillery, the large expensive fortifications, this new technology was becoming ever more expensive, and the very scale of warfare, the size of the armies involved, the length of the campaigns, the time spent in sieges, increased dramatically, a whole series of changes which we've called the military revolution in the past. Now, unlike the other regimes discussed in earlier lectures, unlike the English crown, unlike the Spanish crown, at least in the Netherlands, unlike the Holy Roman Emperor inside of Germany itself, the French crown had acquired the right of direct taxation without consent during the later Middle Ages. The context had been the emergency of the Hundred Years' War, the war between England and France during the later 14th and early 15th century, and in this period of national crisis, the French crown had acquired the right to tax, in a sense, of its own free will, without having to have its fiscal demands approved by some kind of representative assembly like an Estates General. During the 16th century, the French crown's tax bureaucracy would expand even further. And just to give you a few figures, during the year 1520, France had 11 so-called generals of finance, important financial officers, and 11 so-called treasurers of finance. But by the year 1620, there were fully 200 treasurers of finance. And by the year 1640, there would be almost 500. Between the year 1520 and the year 1620, the number of royal tax districts grew from 78 to 143, while the number of officials assigned to these districts, and these officials were somewhat ironically called élus, which implied that they were elected, whereas in fact they were venal officers who bought their position from the crown, the number of these tax officials grew from 120 to something like 1,200. So the scale of the tax bureaucracy really grew impressively over the course of the 17th century, although it should be kept in mind that most of these new positions, most of this expansion was done through selling the offices. So most of the expansion of the tax-holding bureaucracy was done through venal office-holding. What the tax bureaucracy represented, although this seems very strange in the modern mind, is a collection of thousands of individuals who have, in a sense, made an investment, and a fairly heavy investment, in the absolutist state. And as we shall see, the crown would meddle with this investment at its own peril. Nevertheless, for all its prodigious tax revenues, for all the size of its bureaucracy, the French crown was always short of funds during the early modern period. Even in the aftermath of the French Wars of Religion, the French crown had had to make enormous payments to buy out the members of the Catholic League, which had formerly resisted it. What was the French crown to do? How was it going to deal with these massive financial problems? Well, there were three strategies which were adopted. One of these was a standard trick of European kings, and that is the monarchy simply declared bankruptcy. Between 1585 and 1600, the French crown simply stopped paying interest on its debts. A second strategy, and perhaps it's a more commendable one, which was adopted, was more careful management, greater administrative efficiency. Henry IV of France had a talented chief minister, another Huguenot, by the name of the Duke of Sully, and Sully actually managed to freeze, and in some cases even to reduce, the rates of taxation while still increasing overall revenues. The third main strategy pursued by the French crown was a time-honored favorite by this point, the sale of offices. Since the 1520s, the sale of offices had grown significantly in importance, and especially since the 1550s, they'd become an essential cornerstone of French crown finance. Now, the way an office worked is actually kind of interesting and fairly revealing about the structure of the power of the crown. As a recompense for his services, the venal officer was paid an annual salary, which was usually called the gage. And the gage was equivalent to 10% of the price he had paid for the office. That's at least the theory of how a venal officer was compensated. It's not hard to see how the gage, this salary, was really, in effect, a guaranteed 10% return on capital invested with the crown. Now,